Welcome to EmergencyMedicineCases.com. I'm your host, Dr. Anton Hellman, bringing you Canada's brightest minds in emergency medicine from EMC Studios in Toronto. In this episode number 28 on vascular catastrophes, pearls, and pitfalls, we have with us Dr. David Carr and Dr. Anil Chopra. Dr. Carr is an emergency physician at the University Health Network in Toronto and an assistant professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine, Division of Emergency Medicine at the University of Toronto. He serves as the Assistant Director of Education at the UHN and has been the recipient of both undergraduate and postgraduate clinical teaching awards. Dr. Anil Chopra is an emergency physician at the University Health Network in Toronto and an associate professor in the Department of Medicine, University of Toronto. He's the head and medical director of emergency medicine at the University Health Network. The vascular emergencies that we'll be discussing in this episode are some of the ones that often hide behind doors, waiting to jump out and get you. But what do I mean? Well, let's take aortic dissection, for example. Aortic dissection is one of the great masqueraders. It can present just like an MI, just like a stroke, or even in one famous case of the writer of the Broadway musical hit Rent, dissection was misdiagnosed as a gastroenteritis at the primary visit. Aortic dissection can hide itself behind these other diagnoses with disastrous consequences. Let's take another vascular emergency, compartment syndrome. Although we usually think of compartment syndrome after something like a tibial fracture, sometimes compartment syndrome can present after a simple ankle sprain when you least expect it, and the signs are often very subtle. Compartment syndrome, like aortic dissection, can hide behind doors. In this episode, with the help of Dr. Anil Chopra and David Carr, the ED docs who literally wrote the chapter on occlusive arterial disease in the latest Tintinelli's book, will help you open those doors to uncover those oftentimes elusive diagnoses. We'll give you all the pearls and pitfalls you need to know so that next time you're faced with a patient with chest pain or leg pain, you'll be able to confidently rule in or rule out the vascular catastrophes that may be hiding behind doors. So, welcome Dr. Chopra.
Thank you.
And welcome Dr. Carr.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's jump right into the first case. The first case is that of a 50-year-old man who presents to your ED via ambulance with a two-hour history of severe retrosternal chest pain and vomiting. He's been in a board meeting that morning when he suddenly felt a sharp pain in the middle of his chest, started sweating profusely, and then vomited twice. His pain was constant and rated as a 9 out of 10. His vital signs were normal, except for a heart rate of 105. He appeared anxious, in pain, and diaphoretic. His heart sounds are normal, with no murmurs. His chest is clear, abdomen is soft, and non-tender. So Dr. Carr, what are your initial thoughts on this case in terms of the differential diagnosis? And what else would you like to know?
So this is a patient we're going to see 2, 3, 4 times a shift. When I approach any kind of complaint, what I like to do is I like to spit out the diagnosis. I want to consider the most serious cause, the most probable cause, the most interesting cause, and the most treatable cause. I think when you look at that mnemonic, it's a good way for your learners to kind of approach how to address the problem. This person is someone with severe chest pain, and as the clinician on any patient who comes in with chest pain, there are three things you have to rule out. You got to make sure that this person doesn't have ACS, you got to make sure this person doesn't have a PE, and you got to make sure that this person doesn't have a dissection. And if you keep those as the most serious things that you need to rule out, your history has to reflect that. So with this guy, what I'd be worried about with this chest pain, I'd consider those big three. I'd want to focus my history a little bit to see if it's fitting a specific pattern to any of those big three diagnoses, and then do an appropriate physical exam. If he has a PE, look for that DVT. If he has a dissection, maybe look for that murmur.
Dr. Chopra, do you have any other thoughts about this case so far?
Well, I think the history is very telling. Abrupt onset of severe chest pain with sweating is something really bad till proven otherwise. And just some of the other historical factors that are kind of important are the type of pain, the radiation of the pain, whether it goes into the arms, the back, and particularly in terms of whether a very good screening question is it pleuritic or not, sometimes creates a negative or a positive predictive value for what you're thinking. Though this could be a simple pneumothorax or pericarditis or pancreatitis, it's more likely to be sudden coronary occlusion or a pulmonary embolism or a dissection. And in the history, it's also important to consider any recent neurovascular symptoms preceding or following the chest pain and the dynamic nature of the pain episode.
Okay, so some of the things that weren't presented in the case were the radiation of the pain, whether it's pleuritic or not, was the patient short of breath, how sudden was the sudden, was it a truly abrupt onset or was it more of a crescendo onset? And Dr. Carr, as you mentioned, the risk factor is not only for ACS, but for dissection and PE as well. We'll get onto the details of all these things a little bit later. Let's continue with the case. The nurse hands you an ECG, which shows a subtle half a millimeter of ST depression in the inferior leads and flattened T waves in the precordial leads. The patient's given ASA 160 milligrams to chew, and low molecular weight heparin is ordered. A portable chest X-ray is read as normal, and a troponin comes back as borderline positive, and the D-dimer comes back as twice the upper limit of normal. So, Dr. Carr, let's specifically talk here about the troponin and the D-dimer. What could the possible causes of a borderline troponin and an elevated D-dimer be in this patient?
I think the first thing that I want to know is who ordered the D-dimer. I know, was that your advance directive that you put on? Or
I love D-dimers. I have stakes in the company, but I know where you're going, Dr. Carr.
So, I mean, when you see an elevated D-dimer, often it creates this intense kind of gut pressure in us that forces us to consider and then pursue alternative diagnoses. Sometimes that's good, sometimes it's bad, depending on the clinical scenario. I think when you have an elevated D-dimer, the most common cause in someone with chest pain is probably going to be a PE. Now, in the last decade, there's been a lot of talk about D-dimers in aortic dissection. And I think that they need to be treated differently than D-dimers in PE, because this is not a validated kind of approach to the way they've been studied. And the problem with this is there's several studies and several meta-analysis, and they take all these, each study looks at multiple cutoffs. They are all retrospective studies where they test on the control group or only the positive patients. So yes, if you took people with ankle fractures and said your D-dimer is super, super, if it's super, super low, you probably don't have a dissection as well if that's your cutoff group. So it's really hard to interpret what you're thinking with D-dimer for the dissection group. I think it's a test that's not ready for prime time. The other thing about all this D-dimer stuff is how do we interpret it with relation to timing of symptoms? So if you had that dissection story and then 30 minutes later you come in, is your D-dimer going to spill? The other thing is about 12% of dissections have what's called an intramural hematoma. And theoretically, those aren't going to spill D-dimer, making that more difficult. So I've talked a lot about bashing D-dimers in dissection. I don't think we're ready for prime time. When we talk about positive troponins and positive D-dimers, I think the things that people have to consider are a PE most commonly. And obviously there are cause of D-dimer rise that are based on age, and people can have troponin rises based on heart failure or renal impairment and those sort of things. But clearly where we're going with this, the big thing would be, is this a PE? Is this a dissection? And do we need to pursue those two big diagnoses with further testing?
I'll just mention a couple of things. I think neither the D-dimer nor the troponin level is validated yet to be able to exclude the diagnosis of dissection, even though meta-analysis seems to point in the direction that a negative test can exclude the diagnosis. Time will tell. The potential combination of using both markers is also yet to be investigated. The major issue with these markers is the nonspecific nature of them being elevated. The D-dimer can be elevated with any inflammatory or infectious conditions or surgery or advanced age. We know, for example, that a patient age of 80 or more has an elevated D-dimer 90% of the time, even when they're well. So there's a lot of confounding factors. Similarly, the pesky medical condition of troponitis can make our lives difficult when the test is abnormal in non-coronary situations. Secondly, the elevation and magnitude of the elevation is temporally related, as Dr. Carr has already begun talking about. It takes some time from the onset of the illness to elevation, and so theoretically, it's very possible for the early presenters to have both test negative but still have the disease. Though the D-dimer will be positive in nearly all patients with proven dissection, we know that false negatives and low D-dimer levels have been reported in thrombosed false lumen, less extensive disease, and younger patient groups. So a negative D-dimer and a negative troponin, even together, cannot singularly, as yet, exclude the diagnosis in high pretest probability cases where imaging should always be rapidly performed. We're going to need a little bit more data on the non-high risk patients to see where these markers may fit into the future. The bottom line is, in a disease that's going to kill somebody if you miss it, I doubt anybody in terms of a prudent physician would be comfortable with a simple blood test to rule out this life-threatening disease.
Let's continue with the case. In this case, the admitting specialist was consulted, and you go and see some other patients in the emergency department. About 1 hour later, you hear an overhead call to the resuscitation room, and when you get there, your patient has a decreased level of awareness, an unmeasurable blood pressure, and a faint carotid pulse. So Dr. Carr, what are your thoughts in terms of the possibilities to explain this patient's sudden change in clinical status? Given that we've been thinking about the three big diagnoses for chest pain, ACS, PE, and dissection, you now have a patient who's just suddenly dropped their pressure, who's gone into shock. What are your thoughts as to the possibilities of why this has happened?
This case got more interesting. Could this be a PE who's got a massive PE, who's had an arrest? Could this person have dissected and dissected proximally into their pericardium and bled and in hypotensive shock? Could this, the other consideration would be, does this person have an esophageal catastrophe? Did they perf their esophagus and are very, very sick from that?
Okay, so this patient was given normal saline via two peripheral lines, full open, as well as levofed via a central line. And despite these resuscitative efforts, the patient did not regain a measurable BP. A bedside ultrasound was done and showed a huge pericardial effusion. A needle pericardiocentesis was performed, and the cardiovascular surgeon was called. On the way to the OR, the patient suffered a PEA arrest and was unable to be resuscitated. The postmortem showed a type A aortic dissection with massive pericardial effusion. So, Dr. Chopra, let's talk more specifically about aortic dissection. First, could you give our listeners an idea of how lethal aortic dissection is and to what degree time is of the essence in diagnosing and managing these patients?
So again, this depends on the type of dissection. A type A dissection, which involves the aortic arch, is very lethal. Of every 100 patients with type A dissection, one or two die every hour without completion of surgical treatment. So about half of these patients are dead at 24 hours. However, the mortality is even higher in older patients with comorbidity, patients with neurovascular deficits or hemodynamic compromise at presentation. But with successful early surgery, there's an over 90% one-year survival based on international registry data. This is contrasted to type B dissections, which just involve the descending aorta, where the mortality is primarily dependent on good early medical therapy, and in-hospital mortality is actually even less than 10%. Only about 10 to 15% of type B dissections require surgical treatments such as endovascular graft stenting.
It depends on what kind of dissection you have, but the surgical dissections tend to have quite a high mortality, and that's hard to know early on in the ED visit, so I guess you've got to assume that it's a type A dissection until proven otherwise and act quickly.
Yeah, and so type of dissection, but just as importantly, how sick is the patient at presentation? The sicker they are, the much more likely they're going to die in front of you, and you have to act even faster than you might have.
Okay. And Dr. Carr, this is often a difficult diagnosis to make, aortic dissection. Why is it so difficult to make this diagnosis?
It's difficult because the patients, as eloquently put by some of our eMERGE colleagues, don't read the textbook. If you look at the classic descriptions of aortic dissection, the classic triad is this aortic pain, severe sharp pain, this wide or blood pressure difference or pulse difference, this classic abnormalities of an abnormal mediastinum on chest x-ray, that occurs about a quarter of a time. We're focused to look for the classics. Anton, I don't come to you and say, I saw this great case of this guy who had a wide mediastinum with severe chest pain and blood pressure difference, because those are obvious. It's the atypical ones that challenge us. We don't have a decision tree for this. There's no Wells criteria. There's no PERC guidelines. There's just a clinical gestalt. And you have to kind of use a Bayesian approach to figure this out. You have to formulate your own pretest probability as to who needs to be evaluated further. The other thing is there's so many atypical presentations, as I talk about. One of the big things is the IRAD data, the International Registry of Aortic Dissections, which really has done a wonderful job of educating clinicians to how these people present. About 10% of people present with syncope. Wow, if syncope was a crummy diagnosis before, it's even more challenging now throwing that caveat in. And about 5% are painless. So there's lots of dissections with all spectrums that are challenging. Remember, big red, that aorta, can devascularize you from the head to the toe. So any symptoms can cause a dissection. It has to be on your radar.
Generally speaking, aortic dissections are so much less prevalent than MIs and PEs. Some data that says for every 500 MIs, you'll diagnose one dissection. So it's just something that we need to, like you said at the beginning, think about immediately, even though that it's comparatively rare when you compare it to MI.
What's amazing, Dr. Hellman, about this is that this is a rare topic, but you're putting this on your podcast. And this is showing up in literature. This is showing up at conferences because this is one of those can't miss diagnoses. We talk about zebras and rare diagnoses all the time, but of all the zebras we see, this is one you can't miss.
Mm-hmm. One of the things as well, if you talk to the lawyers and they've looked back at...
Oh, wait, hold it. We're in Canada here, Dr. Chopra.
Good point, but occasionally Canadian physicians miss this disease as well.
Really?
It's hard to believe. But one of the things they've actually looked back, when you look at the medical legal cases, the number one reason that it was felt that physicians miss this diagnosis because they didn't think about it. If they think about it, it's much less likely that they're actually going to miss the diagnosis. So really, we've got to get back to what Dr. Carr was saying. It's always got to be on the top of your differential. It's usually very easy, at least intellectually initially, to say, I'm not going to investigate because I don't think this is the disease. As opposed to the cases that have been missed in the past is, oh, I didn't even think about it.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Chopra, there's quite the breadth of presentations when it comes to aortic dissection, making it a difficult diagnosis. Let's start with the classic description. Dr. Carr, you had touched upon this, but let's talk about the classic presentation of aortic dissection with some of the key historical questions you ask your patients. Let's start with the pain itself. What are the key aspects of the pain in dissection that can help us with our pretest probability in deciding whether we're going to work up a patient for dissection or not?
Well, the classical presentation of an acute aortic dissection is acute onset of chest pain that reaches maximal intensity at the onset and radiates to the back between the shoulder blades, as opposed to the MI situation where it's usually a crescendo onset over a couple of minutes or more. And again, based on this international registry data of almost 500 cases, nearly 90% of patients describe the pain as severe or the worst they've ever had at the beginning.
That sounds a lot like the episode we did on headache.
Very true, very true. And this is like the subarachnoid of your chest. And so think of dissection, as we said, similar to exactly as you mentioned, Dr. Hellman. This could be a subarachnoid. This could be an aortic dissection, a very similar kind of cognitive thinking. Classically, the pain is described as tearing or ripping, but in fact, retrospectively, studies have shown the most commonly described type of pain is actually sharp.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because that's not what we were all taught, right? We're all taught tearing and ripping, but sharp's more common.
Absolutely, but I mean, it could also be dull. I mean, if I had dull chest pain going radiating through to my back, the way I have my cognitive differential doesn't change. So you're absolutely right. Now, So, you know, the patients don't always read the book. If they do come in with a classical tearing, ripping, going to the back, come on, who's going to miss that diagnosis? But sharp could be anything, MSK, pulmonary embolism. And again, the problem we have in emergency medicine always is most of our chest pains, most of our abdo pains leave our department without a diagnosis. And so we have the spectrum bias where we think most of the time we'll get, and in fact, I think most of the time we do get away with it, even when sometimes we miss some of these diseases, but aortic dissection is not the disease you want to miss. Getting back to the pain episode, so sometimes the pain is migratory as the dissection advances, going, for example, from your anterior chest progressively down into the abdomen. And as we mentioned, in terms of likelihood ratios, tearing and ripping has a likelihood ratio above 10, though again, most patients present as sharp rather than that. Sudden onset is important. The dynamic nature or migratory type of pain is also significant to keep in mind. It's unlike MI pain, which usually stays in the same descriptive that it begins with.
Yeah, it's interesting with the migratory pain. Most patients who present with migratory pain, it ends up being nothing. And actually, usually my first reaction to someone with migratory pain is, well, there's really not too much it can be. So migratory pain is one of those things that almost all the time it's nothing, but in terms of serious diagnoses, when it comes to chest or back pain, you always got to think about aortic dissection because, like you said, it's extremely unlikely to be MI or PE even when it's migratory pain.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, Dr. Hellman, you said, you know, if somebody comes in with intermittent few seconds of pain that goes from the left to the right to the middle to the back, that's less concerning. Anything, though, when the symptoms are going from above your diaphragm to below your diaphragm or your upper back to your lower back, you really got to think of something serious. And the thing is, these people, though, as Dr. Carr mentioned, sure, 10% may actually not even have pain, but majority of these people have severe pain. They have abrupt, quick pain. So most of these patients, if you think about it, are not as difficult as sometimes we think it they might be. One of the studies, for example, in CHEST 1998, showed that if you ask three simple questions, your chance of diagnosing or at least thinking about aortic dissection is significantly increased. Those three important questions that I think we should all at least think about and ask about are the quality of the pain, number one, the pain intensity and onset, number two, and three, the radiation, as I've mentioned before. And in this particular study, 90% of the ED docs suspected dissection before any work was initiated if you asked all three of the questions. And if you didn't, half the docs didn't think of the diagnosis. So again, very, very important to keep these three types of important questions in mind. And keep in mind as well that the pain can be intermittent. It can change given the dynamic nature of the tear, how it propagates. You put 10 patients together with the similar type of dissection, the pain quality and the dynamic nature will often be different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that study. If docs ask about the quality, the intensity, onset, and radiation of the pain, I mean, this is the basic medical stool stuff that we all learn. And I just find it interesting that as we get more experience in emergency medicine, we cut some corners. But this isn't a good example of just that basic stuff, that if you just hit those very basic questions, the pain questions, that will really increase your likelihood that you're going to pick up on this diagnosis.
So let's keep this simple. And space won't defeat us. No pity, no pedestals. No distance to cheat us.
All right, so Dr. Carr, Dr. Chopra did a fantastic job describing the classic presentation of aortic dissection. Let's move on now to the atypical presentations. You had mentioned that that's one of the reasons why dissection is such a hard diagnosis to make. Can you describe for us some of the atypical presentations that we should be on the lookout for?
The real fun stuff is, as Dr. Chopra put, the chest pain above and below the diaphragm. That's where the astute clinician comes in. What I like to think of the chest pain plus one. So chest pain plus stroke. And as I mentioned earlier, the aorta is devascularized from head to toe. So your symptoms can be anywhere, and that's the challenge. When you think about symptoms above and below the diaphragm, as Dr. Chopra mentioned earlier, there are several key things you have to think about. When you have chest pain plus, let's say, stroke symptoms, you wonder, is this a type A dissection that's dissected retrovertebrally and picked off one of the carotids leading to a stroke? So that would be, when you see chest pain plus stroke, you got to just be a little bit slow to give that TPA. You got to think, wow, is this stroke symptom, given the person had sudden chest pain first, actually a manifestation of a dissection? And you can understand how devastating that would be if you didn't pick up that initial chest pain that triggered this stroke. Your therapy would be poison. The other thing to be think about, other weird presentations are chest pain plus MI. So when you come backwards, you can tear off the right coronary artery. So you get this chest pain and then you have a right coronary artery tear, and that's what you're going to see with the dissection. If you're going to dissect in the setting of an MI, it's going to be right coronary, which means electrocardiographically, territorially speaking, you're going to have an inferior MI. And that's a whole can of worms to open up to discuss about dissection and MI, as the therapies are very different. Other kind of classic above and below the diaphragm are chest pain plus paralysis. You pick off one of the spinal arteries, so you come in with a paralysis of your legs, or a chest pain plus acute limb ischemia, because you've knocked off the aortas, the way the tear has knocked off one of the branches of the femoral arteries or something like that. And lastly, chest pain plus hoarseness. I just almost saw this last month. I was so excited because I really thought I saw an Ortner syndrome. An Ortner syndrome is someone who has a recurrent laryngeal nerve palsy because of his or her dissection. I had a patient in the hospital who said, I can't talk. And I said, well, why can't you talk? She said, well, I had this severe chest pain and I was shopping and now I can't talk. And I said, well, if your kid was drowning, can you tell me how you would scream out to them to save him? And she whispered, help, help. So I got really excited about this. I thought I had my first dissection with a recurrent laryngeal nerve palsy, but it wasn't.
It was psychogenic?
Yeah, for the most part. And I thought she had a psychogenic flavor, but I really was hoping. But the point was, when you have chest pain plus symptoms above or below, you have to go fishing.
I'd actually like to tell you about a more common presentation, which I think is very challenging for the eMERGE doc, and that is somebody who presents with abdominal and back pain. We are trained to think of a leaking AAA, and now we have a fast scan in the emergency department. So we quickly scan the fast scan, find nothing, and we seem reassured that there's no leaking AAA, but in fact, we're missing the type B dissection. I have heard of these cases gone home. So this is a particularly relatively common presentation that we have to be very careful about not to miss. Even type B dissections can be very challenging, particularly when they present with abdominal and some back pain, because we're usually thinking of the more commoner diagnosis, cholecystitis, gallstones, and maybe a leaking AAA. And because we have this bedside fantastic test to rule out, we feel reassured, and that's one of the very important case scenarios. We shouldn't miss a type B dissection.
You know, one of our colleagues in our department, you know, when I come on to work, I always say, do you see anything cool? I always want to know what's exciting. And one of our colleagues said to me, Dave, I saw this great case. The internal medicine resident says, I think there's a surgical belly. So he said, okay. So he goes, sees this person, and he thought maybe he had a triple A, like Dr. Chopra mentioned, and he puts the ultrasound on the belly. And he says, I said, oh, what did it show? He said, he had a retinal detachment. I said, what are you talking about? He had a retinal detachment. He said, well, I put the probe on, and I saw a flap, and that flap looked like the flap that I've seen when people have a retinal detachment on ultrasound. And he said, I don't know what that flap is, but given I'm not looking at that eye, I wonder if he has a dissection. And sure enough, the patient had a type B dissection. And I think the future, if you think dissection, even a quick ultrasound to look at the pericardium to see if there's blood, because maybe you've dissected backwards, or with type Bs to look at the aorta, also looking for that false lumen.
Great stuff. Just a little warning in terms of ultrasound. Of course, you can't hang your hat on a negative ultrasound if you're thinking the patient might have dissection, that most of us aren't trained to be looking at dissections with a high enough accuracy to hang our hat on the bedside ultrasound. But if you're lucky enough to see it and you're wondering what it is and you are thinking about the possibility of a dissection, that's obviously helpful.
One of our really experienced ultrasonographers at our hospital said that even in the best of hands, the sensitivity is less than 20%. But as Dr. Carr said, we're going to do the scan anyways for looking for other things, mm-hmm. and you might get lucky, and clearly looking for pericardial blood makes a lot of sense.
Okay. So we've talked about the classic presentation. We've talked about the atypical presentations to think about dissection in patients who present with pain above and below the diaphragm, patients who present with chest pain with stroke symptoms, patients who present with chest pain and syncope, patients who present with what looks like an inferior MI. It could still be a dissection. We'll get onto that a little bit later. Dr. Chopra, let's go back and talk about the history a little bit more. We're all pretty good at asking about cardiac ischemic risk factors and thromboembolic risk factors when patients present with chest pain, but perhaps not so good at asking for risk factors when it comes to dissection, probably because, as we were mentioning before, it's a relatively rare diagnosis. What are some of the risk factors that we should be asking about in a patient who presents with chest pain or back pain and we're unsure of the diagnosis?
Well, nearly all of the risk factors are in some way increase your intimal wall stress by weakening the medial layer of the aorta, causing the dissection. One thing I always keep in mind is that 3/4 of these patients have a history of hypertension. Age makes a difference because the majority of these dissections occur in the age of 60 to 80, though I'll get into some of the risk factors to ask for in younger. A family history of dissection is important, but again, if you haven't even thought about the possibility of dissection, you may not ask about it. Recent decelerative injuries, such as an MVA with deployment of an airbag, seems to be becoming a more commoner mechanism than we used to see 50 years ago when there were no airbags. Prior cardiac surgery is present in about 1/5 of all the patients, particularly aortic valve replacement. Keeping that in mind is very important. Presence of an aortic aneurysm, which is true in about 13% of all cases who present with dissection to the emergency room. Other things like inflammatory conditions, such as vasculitis. Iatrogenic causes also need to be kept in mind, such as recent cardiac catheterizations, because it seems like everybody and their brother is getting a cardiac catheterization these days. Now, what about the younger group? Now, this is actually a very fascinating group. So patients under the age of 40, let's say, particularly what's been found, again, in the international registry data, that cocaine use is reported to be positive in 1/3 of patients under the age of 40 when you look at dissections collected in urban inner city centers in the U.S. But we do know now with the disseminated use of street drugs, basically these are all comers anywhere. So cocaine history is kind of important to consider with anybody having chest pain, though having said that, acute coronary syndromes also are associated with cocaine use. Pregnancy is another risk factor, particularly in the third trimester in women under the age of 40. 1/2 of dissections which occur in women are in women who are pregnant. Then, of course, there are connective tissue diseases. Primarily, we're looking at individuals with Marfan's, but occasionally also people with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. But always keep in mind congenital heart disease, including bicuspid aortic valve, which increases your risk by 9 times the baseline coarctation of the aorta, and maybe even some more commoner stuff in the younger patients, like using other sympathomimetic street drugs instead of cocaine, using methamphetamine such as ecstasy. And some of the less common, but you know, something that's commonly done, particularly in our male population, it could be as simple as weightlifting. So you know, the risk is long and distinguished. You're unlikely going to ask or screen for these risk factors unless it triggered in your mind that if on your differential diagnosis, you actually had dissection.
Mm-hmm. So maybe just as a basic screening, let's say you've got a patient with chest pain, it doesn't seem obvious. Certainly you're going to be asking for hypertension for ACS anyhow. I guess a family history of dissection is an easy, quick one to ask about. And then again, in young patients, you're probably going to be asking about cocaine again for ACS. But maybe that'll help you think about dissection. And pregnancy, and especially postpartum, it's an easy one to miss because it's, you know, it's usually obvious that the patient's pregnant in their third trimester, but if they're postpartum, you might not think about asking about that. Could you just go over briefly what a Marfan's patient looks like? Because that seems to be one that's quite commonly missed. because patients with Marfan's don't look that much different than the rest of the population. What are some of the things that you might look for, Dr. Carr?
So I think, Dr. Hellman, you raised a good point. Young person with chest pain, I go with traditional risk factors, non-marfanoid, no cocaine. That covers my butt in some ways. When you think about Marfan's, people don't tell you I have Marfan's. I work out at the gym, and I always see this guy. I'm a tall guy. I'm about 6'5". He's about 6'5", but he weighs 160. He makes me nervous every time I'm on the elliptical machine because I'm always looking at him, and I just want to say to him, you have Marfan's. So the NBA screens for Marfan's, and these tend to be tall people. They tend to be tall people who are very thin, and they have some features, if they're alive, to talk about. One, they're tall, thin. They can have a pectus deformity in their chest. They're very hypermobile. So these are the people who have these wonderful party tricks where they can curl their thumb around their hand. They can touch their tongue when they stick it out to the tip of the nose, a positive Gorlin sign. They can hyperextend their wrist so that their fingers will touch their forearm. And it's a hereditary thing. So asking about sudden death, asking about looking at the lineage of the family members, it's a scary thing. I can tell you, as Dr. Chopra brought up so astutely, this point about women who are pregnant making up a big subgroup of the under 40 population. Once every couple years, someone goes to L&D or to the Emerge, depending on what the setup is, and says, I have back pain. And they say, oh, it's your first pregnancy. They slap on the fetal monitors and they say, there's no contractions. This is just false labor. And once every so often, someone's going to present that way and have a type B, have a dissection. So scary, scary subgroup.
Yeah, and what's actually complicated in these patients is that there's often a delay in diagnosis of this two particular subgroup. The tall, thin person, when they come in with sudden onset of sharp pain, they're usually going down a pneumothorax pathway initially. So there's a little bit of a delay in the thinking of the differential diagnosis, including dissection, particularly since they're young and otherwise, unless they're known to be Marfanoid, are relatively healthy. So again, a delay, or maybe the patient may even be discharged home and then later come in trouble. Secondarily, pregnant women, as you mentioned, Dr. Hellman, very importantly, that peripartum period is extremely important. But the third trimester in peripartum, the number one diagnosis in these patients initially that physicians think about is pulmonary embolism. So again, you may be going down the wrong pathway till either the patient deteriorates or is discharged home, or after a negative test, then you start thinking of it. So in these two patient populations, we have to be very careful not to delay the investigation for the more important disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when it comes to the postpartum patient, I've seen postpartum patients with MI because they're actually at increased risk for MI as well. And we had a terrible case of a woman in her third trimester who came in and arrested, and the postmortem showed that she had dissected out her entire aorta. So yeah, again, third trimester and postpartum patients are at increased risk not only for PE but also for MI and dissection. In terms of Marfanoid features, I just want to highlight that, you know, when you're examining the chest, when you're listening to the heart sounds, just take a look at the anatomy of their chest wall, and if they have pectus excavatum, that should be something also that triggers you. Sometimes what I'll do, if I suspect it, I might get the patient to stand up with their arms at their sides, because patients with Marfan's have longer wingspans, so to speak. The span of their arms is more than their height. And so often you'll see their arms dangling down way below their waist. And that's sometimes a prominent feature as well.
It makes for a good rebounder in the NBA.
Yeah, but as Michael Phelps has been tested for...
Michael Phelps has been tested. I actually know about this because I read about this. And he has had surveillance, apparently, according to Wikipedia, which is an excellent medical source and other wonderful things. He has had repeated ultrasounds because he's built to swim. He's a floppy guy. He's tall, thin, floppy, and very mobile. Wonderful swimmer.
Yep.
And does not have Marfan's.
Does not, but probably has something else.
All right. Dr. Carr, let's talk a little bit more about the physical exam for patients who present with chest pain and dissections in the differential. Can you tell us what you look for specifically on physical exam for these kinds of patients?
Absolutely. The first point I want to get at is, this is a disease of hypertension, of chronic hypertension for the most part. But you have to keep in mind that 35% of these patients are normotensive when they come in and 16% are hypotensive when they come in. So half of the patients when they come to the Emerge do not actually appear hypertensive.
Right.
So that's a kind of caveat. I think the thing that people often focus on and the nurses focus on is this business of bilateral blood pressures. And Singer and Hollander in the Archives of Internal Medicine in 96 did a study that looked at blood pressure differences on healthy people. And what they found is that 53% of patients have a blood pressure difference greater than 10 in systolic blood pressure, and 19% have a blood pressure difference greater than 20. So it's very common to have a blood pressure difference. So you can't hang your hat on that as a rule out or a rule in. It certainly makes us nervous when someone has a blood pressure difference, but come on, when you have a blood pressure difference of 18, that isn't your indication to scan someone. There has to be more. One of the more telling findings, we always worry about blood pressure, is something that is so easy for us to check, which is to check the pulse quality on both sides. So I'll put my fingers and feel the radial pulses. And if I notice that on one side there's a different strength to it, a different timing, a different character of it, then it really makes you worry about pathology. Whether they have a subclavian steal or whether in the setting of a dissection story, you can hang your hat that there's something abnormal in their aortic vasculature if someone, the quality of their pulses between both arms is different. And I find that's a helpful thing. There are other physical exam maneuvers that one can perform to detect aortic dissection apart from just looking at the vitals. Clearly, if you're wonderful with your stethoscope, as Dr. Chopra, I'm sure you are, you might pick up that diastolic murmur. Hard to do in a busy emerge where we work, where you can't always hit that diastolic murmur. But a new diastolic murmur in the setting of chest pain makes you want to worry about things. The presence of signs and symptoms of pericardial fusion, as we talked about earlier, if someone's dissected back and has quiet heart sounds, elevated JVP, or the elevated JVP of CHF, or of course with any of the unusual presentations we talked about, chest pain plus stroke symptoms, chest pain plus limb ischemia, any other physical exam findings that support that, those atypical presentations.
I'll have you know, Dr. Carr, my auscultation skills are excellent. On every single one of my charts, it's always written, heart sounds distant.
You know, Dr. Chopra uses one of those $30 nurse's stethoscopes to hear his diastolic murmurs just to prove his clinical superiority, I think.
I've got a little bit of a bias because when I applied to medical school, I also applied to music recording engineering at the same time. And so my ears are a little bit more attuned than most, I think. But still, I can't hear murmurs three quarters of the time.
But listen, guys, if we were really serious that much of the time the heart sounds are going to make as much of a difference, we really would be using our ultrasound probe to listen to heart sounds. I mean, it's much more accurate than a stethoscope. But we carry on as we usually do. Occasionally get what we get lucky and hear the big murmurs, which I think is the important thing.
I can hear her heartbeat from 1,000 miles. Yeah, the heavens open every time she smiles. And when I come to her, that's where I belong. Yet I run into her like a river song.
So we've talked about the physical exam. Let's move on to some of the tests that we might do for patients with chest pain, and we'll start, of course, with the ECG. Dr. Chopra, how can the ECG help or hinder us in the chest pain patient who we suspect might have a dissection?
Well, as we know, an ECG done as soon as possible for a patient with chest pain is a standard of care. It's extremely important, but primarily to exclude other causes of chest pain. Other than dissection, I mean, including ACS, pericarditis/myocarditis. It is rare to find ECG signs of an acute inferior STEMI or a complete heart block related to type A dissections. About 70% of registry patients with an aortic dissection had ECG abnormalities, but most of these are nonspecific, including LVH, probably from long-standing hypertension, nonspecific STT changes, which may mislead you to diagnosing acute coronary ischemia, and you mistakenly anticoagulate the patient, which could be a disaster. But ECG changes in patients with their aortic dissections are thought to be due to either A, chronic changes related, as I mentioned, to pre-existing coronary disease, hypertension, cardiomyopathy, and so on. But they could also be acute changes, as I mentioned, if the dissection goes into the right coronary sulcus, If it's an incomplete obstruction, you could get ST depression and T wave inversion. If it's a complete obstruction, transmural, it'll give you essentially an ST elevation, MI, appearance of an inferior MI. Lastly, as well, a shocky state in patients with dissection can lead to ECG changes. And of course, cardiac tamponade can manifest as acute ECG changes as well.
So Dr. Chopra, in the case that I presented, the astute emergency doctor pulled out the bedside ultrasound and found that the patient had a large size pericardial effusion. Dr. Carr, you had touched upon this earlier. How do aortic dissections cause pericardial effusions, and how should we be managing these patients once they've developed a pericardial effusion in the setting of an aortic dissection?
So pericardial collections of blood can occur with retrograde propagation of the intimal tear into the pericardial sac. If one is detected on ultrasound and there are no early signs of tamponade, then the management is still early surgical management of the dissection by a CV surgeon. However, cardiac tamponade is one of the most common causes of early mortality with a type A dissection, with at least a 60% mortality rate. And so one must proactively be vigilant for it. From the ED physician perspective, the management is similar to other forms of tamponade, including the ABCs and ultrasound-guided decompression of the pericardial space while waiting for the surgeons to assist with consideration of an emergency pericardial drain or even sometimes a pericardial window to temporize the patient to reach the operating room alive.
Now, this is always a tough decision because, you know, theoretically, you put a needle in and you start draining the blood out of the pericardial sac and you just get more and more blood coming and more and more blood coming. The patient just goes further into shock. You're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place.
But now what I'm saying is if you find it and it's clinically, I mean, cardiac tamponade is really, for the emerge physician, a clinical diagnosis. If they've got a sac full of blood and they're in cardiogenic type shock, you or somebody else has to stick a needle in. Mm-hmm.
So for the patient with a dissection who might have a pericardial effusion, if they're not in shock, then don't stick a needle in there because it might put them into shock. But if they are in shock, they're near death, then you've got to put a needle in. You really don't have any choice and get them to the OR as fast as you possibly can.
Yeah, Hippocratic oath number one, don't cause harm. So if you don't think, having blood in the sac is a bad prognostically. But really all that means is you should be in a bigger hurry to get them to the operating room. So if they don't collapse and don't go into cardiac tamponade in your emerge, leave them alone. Key thing is you should be rushing them to the OR.
Great. Without imaging.
Absolutely.
That's the take-home.
Pretest clinical probability dissection with cardiac tamponade, no-brainer. Don't be doing imaging. Don't let the consultant tell you over the phone, get a CT scan. You should be saying, why are you not here yet?
Okay, so we've talked about the ECG, a bit about bedside ultrasound. Let's move on to the chest X-ray. Dr. Carr, Rosen's lists about 10 different findings on chest X-ray for aortic dissection, some of which are pretty subtle, and I, for one, can't memorize them all. What are the most important findings on chest X-ray for aortic dissection, and how sensitive is chest X-ray in general to rule out dissection?
When you look at what we classically describe in aortic dissections, we're all taught about a widened mediastinum. That occurs in about 80% of patients with dissection. So what the flip side of that is 21% have the absence of a wide mediastinum. 12% have a completely normal chest X-ray as read by a radiologist. So when you add 12 plus 21, a third of our patients that we see are going to have no abnormalities whatsoever, that most of us are going to call this completely normal. There are some other findings to look at, and these are findings like the displaced calcium signs. So when you tear in your intima, the calcium in long-standing people with hypertension will move so that, or when you look at it radiologically, you'll see calcium displaced with the intima. So you'll see two little lines.
So with a calcium sign, you're looking at the knob of the aorta and a separation of the calcified intima from the outermost portion of the aorta by more than 5 millimeters would be considered a positive calcium sign. And that has a pretty good positive predictive value for aortic dissection?
It's really good if you see it.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't see it that commonly. right? It's only seen in something like 14% of patients with dissection. But if you see it, there's not a lot that causes that.
Okay, so you'll look for, aside from wide mediastinum, one of the key features is this calcium sign. We'll have an image of the calcium sign on the written summary.
Yeah, I think looking at abnormal aortic contour, and then as you mentioned with the calcium displacement in the arch, looking at abnormal cardiac contour, maybe if you have a big pericardial effusion, some of us are familiar with that kind of globby looking heart. And then there's pleural effusions that also occur in about 20%. What you have to also realize is I'm speaking about dissections as a general term, but if you look at type A for ascending, and type B, they radiologically look different. As you can imagine, if you tear more proximally, you're more likely to have a widened mediastinum than if you have a more distal tear. So some of these findings are dependent on where the tear is.
Mm-hmm. That kind of gets me just thinking about, do you think there's any predictive value in the location of pain and what type of dissection it is? For example, if you have severe upper chest pain versus, you know, maybe lower chest pain radiating into the abdomen, will the former be more likely to be a type A and the latter be more likely to be a type B?
So absolutely. If you look at IRAD, you'll say that 45% of people complain of back pain in a type A dissection, but 64% complain of it in type B, and those differences were statistically significant. So there's no doubt that back pain is a more type B symptom. And all these symptoms and all these signs radiologically really depend where you have the tear, making this diagnosis exceptionally challenging.
So when it comes to chest x-rays, the timing is sometimes an important feature, and I'll explain what I mean. Dr. Chopra, let's say you're in a hospital where thrombolysis is given for acute STEMIs, and a patient like the one in our case presents to the emergency department. Let's say the patient has ECG criteria for thrombolysis. We already mentioned that about 5% of dissections will also have ACS, usually an inferior MI. Would you suggest that we routinely get a chest x-ray before thrombolyzing the patient to make sure the patient doesn't have a wide mediastinum?
No, absolutely not. I think the key to all these potentially lethal conditions is, again, the history and the past medical history. The chest x-ray lacks, as Dr. Carr alluded to, lacks sufficient sensitivity to be useful to exclude a diagnosis of dissection on the face of a non-low pretest clinical probability. So if the patient looks like an ACS without a significant suspicion for a dissection, which of course is clinical judgment, go ahead and use whatever reperfusion strategy is available to you in a timely manner. Obviously in Canada, for the most part, that means thrombolysis. You certainly don't want to delay lytics to a patient with a STEMI because time is muscle and the patient will have a poor prognosis as the delays get longer. However, we don't want to give thrombolytics to a patient because the patient will have a higher chance of bleeding to death, cardiac tamponade, perioperative complications, etc., if we give it obviously to a patient inadvertently who has dissection. If you're caught in a bind of diagnosing a STEMI but also have a significant suspicion for a dissection, then you're really obligated to avoid lytics and either consider PCI if you live under a cath lab or can get the patient to a cath lab, which will further define the anatomy and help exclude one or include the diagnosis. Or on the other hand, you will have to go down the line of managing as best you can the potential ACS without anticoagulating while investigating for the dissection. Key thing is get the consultants involved early in these complicated patients.
Let's move on to talking about imaging. How do you decide which definitive imaging test to do for dissection?
Well, the decision on choosing the right imaging depends, obviously, with most other fancy imaging, on availability of resources and patient factors. CTA is the commonest imaging test used in North America to make the diagnosis in the hemodynamically stable patient, and it's often readily available. Some would say we're, as you know, Dr. Carr and Dr. Hummel, we're kind of CT crazy. Well, here's a diagnosis where CT is actually very useful. CTA is over 90% sensitive for the diagnosis of dissection and will almost always visualize the intraluminal clot of and any significant pericardial blood, though, you know, it's only about 75% sensitive for the intimal tear itself. So if the patient is hemodynamically unstable, it's less desirable to send the patient outside of the emergency department for a CT. And so then I think a transesophageal echo is the preferred test at the bedside, again, if local expertise allows for this study to be done in the emergency department. It, again, is almost 100% sensitive for type A dissection. Though a transthoracic ultrasound has poor sensitivity for picking up a dissection itself, again, as we've already mentioned, it does have utility. It's a very quick and useful bedside modality, as we've seen with our case, in this particular case, in detecting pericardial blood, but can also reveal an aortic insufficiency or severe LV dysfunction, which can help in your differential diagnosis. Now, a crashing patient who has a strong pretest clinical probability for a dissection needs no further imaging, and that really needs to be stressed, as we already have. That patient is essentially operating room deficient. An MRI, though, also has a very high sensitivity, probably around 98%, but is usually not available in a timely manner, though can be considered in stable patients with renal failure, for example. It can become challenging, as we all know, to request a CTA, i.e. a CT with IV contrast, for a patient with a creatinine clearance of less than 30. So we're talking generally anybody with a creatinine above 175, you likely may get into a not-so-happy discussion with the radiologist. But, you know, what are we worried about here? We're worried about a disease that's going to kill the patient. Every hour that goes by, the patient's more likely to die. So if CTA is the only thing you got, readily available, the best test that you think you can provide in a timely manner, ignore the creatinine, push for this study, because the potential decline in renal function with IV contrast is usually reversible, but the consequences of delaying the diagnosis and management of dissection is going to kill the patient. Overall, all three imaging techniques, TEE, helical CT, MRI, yield clinically equally reliable diagnostic values for confirming or ruling out thoracic aortic dissection, but in every emergency department, the choice, the availability, and the patient factors will dictate what you're going to grab onto first.
Since CT has improved over the last 20 years, we're picking up other related aortic conditions like penetrating ulcers and intramural hematomas of the aorta. Dr. Carr, can you tell our listeners what we need to know about these conditions if we find them while we're working up these patients for dissection?
One of the findings you'll hear is that when you have dissections, about 12% of the time you'll have what's called an intramural hematoma. And an intramural hematoma is a tear within the vasovisorum. And where I talked about this earlier, or where I think about this, is in terms of a D-dimer rise that you don't get. And it was something that theoretically was brought up to say, well, if you have an intramural hematoma, you won't get a D-dimer rise, and therefore we shouldn't use D-dimers to rule out dissection. The bigger issue is, what do you do when you find an intramural hematoma on CT? You need a vascular surgeon to get involved. This is a condition that needs to be treated quite similar to a dissection in terms of you're going to have similar management priorities.
Yeah, I think the hematoma is just, as far as the emerge doc is concerned, is just a precursor to the dissection. But the good thing is that, similar to a penetrating ulcer or a hematoma, it at least buys you a little bit of time, as opposed to a dissection is occurring and is dynamic and the pressure is pushing the dissection further and further. As far as we're concerned, that is an ultra emergency, as we've already talked about. If I get a penetrating ulcer, I mean, an uncommon finding, probably occasionally it's a radiological diagnosis, I can assure you it wasn't something at the top of my list when I was thinking about it. Again, I think it's a sigh of relief. It's something you need to talk to the surgeon about in terms of management. There are different approaches to how you manage a penetrating ulcer. Depends on the age of the patient, the comorbidity, how are you going to manage. It is an urgency for sure, but it's nothing that you would be... The treatment algorithm is different for a penetrating ulcer than it is for dissection. The surgeon's going to get involved. You have some time to think about it. The aorta has not ruptured. It's unlikely to rupture in front of you with a penetrating ulcer, but that obviously is the short-term and long-term risk. And so definitive management of the ulcer is in the realm of the surgeon.
We're often presented with patients who have chest pain, who we're not sure of the diagnosis, and we keep the big bad ones in the back of our minds all the time. What about this triple rule out coronary CT angiography? This is the one that has gained some popularity in the States. It's a CT angiography that'll look at the coronary arteries to try and give you an idea of whether the patient's chest pain is caused by ACS. It'll also look for PE and it'll look for dissection. Do you think the triple rule out coronary CT angiography has much of a role in these patients who present with chest pain who you're not sure of the diagnosis?
Thank you very much for that question, Dr. Hellman. It is a hot potato. Maybe we can pass it on to Dr. Carr. I have my biases, but it is relatively evidence-based. We are, in certain areas of the world, going crazy for coronary CT, whether you need it or not. Some people are joking you shouldn't actually walk into an emergency room without having a head-to-the-toe CT scan. I think we need to be a little bit careful here. There's more and more accumulating studies in the literature about the possible utility of coronary CT being a cost-effective strategy for risk stratifying patients suspected of ACS in an acute environment, such as the emergency department. Problem is that it really depends on pretest clinical probability. In Canada, we as a group seem to be extremely good at sending these patients home who are non-high risk. In fact, we sent 80% of all chest pains home that present to the emergency department. As opposed to other environments, let's say south of the border, majority of these patients are admitted. So again, the cost effective and utility of finding what you're looking for is a little bit different. I think what we're worried about in the case that we discussed, the two primary diagnoses we're worried about that the CT can really help us out in is pulmonary embolism and aortic dissection. So we should be talking about this situation with our radiologist and saying, can we phase the CT scan so we can look for both diagnoses and either exclude one or both? That's the way to go. We should not be worried about doing a coronary CT, figuring out calcium scores. First of all, it's not validated yet, particularly in an environment where we're not just looking at moderate risk patients or low risk patients. If you're high risk for ACS, you're going to get admitted. If my CAT scan is going to rule out PE dissection, I'm done. I'm going to manage that. We're going to have to reconsider my differential diagnosis. And I'm now going to probably manage the patient as if they now absolutely don't have the life-threatening aortic dissection or pulmonary embolism. And I don't need a CT to tell me that now I'm worried about coronary disease per se. So I'd say talk to the radiologist. If the differential is dissection, PE, then ask for an appropriately done CT that looks for both.
I think Dr. Chopra said it perfectly. I think this is this business of vomit syndrome, victims of modern imaging technology. I think we need to not use therapeutic doses of radiation to curb our curiosities.
So I just want to highlight that there's two points in one's workup of the chest pain patient who has an aortic dissection that you can be steered away from the diagnosis. And in other words, there's two key pitfall points. First is the ECG showing ischemic changes and assuming that the changes are from cardiac ischemia alone. And the second is if you get a positive D-dimer and assume that the patient has a PE. In both these situations, the treatment for cardiac ischemia and PE includes heparin and possibly thrombolysis, which would be a clean kill if the patient had an aortic dissection. Dr. Carr, we had talked about how the patient who presents with aortic dissection can have a low blood pressure or can be normotensive or hypertensive. Let's talk about blood pressure management in the patient who has a high blood pressure. Let's say they come into the department with a classic story for aortic dissection and their blood pressure is 210 over 120. Could you review for us the blood pressure management in this kind of situation?
Absolutely. One of the best things about this condition is you don't have to be smart. This is the hypertensive emergency where you don't have to worry about dropping the blood pressure too quickly. In fact, you're rewarded for knocking down that blood pressure. You don't have to calculate 30% reduction in MAPs and all this sort of mathematical stuff. You want to get these people down. And you want to get these people down to a systolic blood pressure of about 110 to 120 and a heart rate of about 60. And what this does is it eliminates the stress on the aortic wall and some of the shearing forces that we see in patients with dissection. So you really want to bring these people down. And I think your point, Dr. Hellman, of what do you do when you have the classic story is you bring them down prior to imaging. There are people we bring down prior to imaging. You have someone who has a PE clinically. They come in. You know it's a PE. You can wait for your CT to prove it. But if that patient's sick and has a life-threatening diagnosis, you anticoagulate them. And in this group, you bring down their blood pressure. How do you bring down your blood pressure? Without a doubt, your first line is going to be a beta blocker, an IV beta blocker, be it labetalol or esmolol, depending on what you have available and what you're more comfortable with. And these are things that have very short half-lives, especially esmolol, so you can really titrate an effective dose. If you can't get the blood pressure to the 110, 120, heart rate 60 rule, your second line would be sodium nitroprusside. What you always have to be cautioned is you never start a vasodilator first in isolation. Because if you have a vasodilator aboard without a beta blocker, you can get a reflex tachycardia. And we know the last thing we want in this dissection patient is to make them tachycardia. So you start with your beta blocker, you aggressively lower their blood pressure as fast as you can get it down in a safe fashion. And if you're having difficulties with that, your second line would be to add nitroprusside.
In the last decade or two, as Dr. Carr has mentioned, we've now been told, don't treat the blood pressure in people who present to the emergency department. I don't care if it's 200. There's only a couple of conditions where we seriously have to consider dropping the blood pressure right away. Dissection, eclampsia, maybe bleeding in the brain. That's still controversial.
Dr. Carr, we were taught in medical school that type A dissections, the one that involve the ascending aorta, are treated surgically, while type B dissections, the ones that don't involve the ascending aorta, are treated medically with blood pressure control. What are the exceptions to this rule? In other words, what are the indications for surgery in the type B dissections, the ones that are usually treated medically?
So I think that's a really interesting question. The three of us in this room work in centers where we have cardiovascular or thoracic surgeons to deal with this. A lot of our listeners don't work in those centers. I think there are two questions to be addressed. One is, what are the indications for surgery? But two, the bigger indication is, what are the indications to be transferred to a center that has a surgeon available? And I think those are very different points. I think for type A's, you need to go to a center for sure, and you need surgery immediately. For type B, the sort of indications for surgery are if you are having malperfusion, if you are having rupture, if you are having progression of the tail, or failure of medical therapy, if you're having an expanding aortic diameter. That being said, my bias would be if you have a type B, you should be on the phone. It's not your surgeon at your hospital, on the phone with someone at another hospital to have them aware of this early, because an appropriate transfer might be in order. Instead of waiting for those complications, think about transferring early and treating early. Be aggressive with your treatment with blood pressure. For type A's, get your surgeon in the emergency yesterday. And for type B's, look for those signs, those failure of medical therapy, the progression of disease, the malperfusion, the aortic rupture, but get a surgeon involved in the care early, be it at your shop or someone else's. Last thing I want to say about this disorder in closing, in my final thoughts, is this is an amazing diagnosis. And it's an amazing diagnosis that the emergency physician has the power to make. It's a diagnosis if you make, you pat yourself on the back, because you've saved someone's life. The challenge is making that diagnosis in the atypical patient. When you make that diagnosis, you made a big difference. When you have those cases, share those stories, because we all will see the atypical dissection. And if we share the gospel of the interesting dissections, then maybe one day on that next shift, you'll see that same patient. And you'll make that diagnosis.
These guys did such a great job reviewing the key pearls and pitfalls of aortic dissection that I don't feel like I need to do a review here, but I would direct you to the written summary where we'll have a nice, concise review that'll help you remember all these key pearls and pitfalls.